This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest has more than two decades of experience as a sports and entertainment executive, the bulk of which has been spent in the international space. Janae Elzy's background includes working at the NBA, the Tennis Channel, NBC Universal, and elsewhere. A former All-American gymnast at Stanford University, Janae has focused much of her career in the sports world, where she has done a lot of work helping and mentoring youth. Her current position is Chief Growth Officer for Athletes First Partners, where she's charged with developing and implementing growth strategies across international and other non-traditional revenue streams. Joining us from New York City now is Janae Elzy. Janae, welcome to Sports Jam.
Thank you, Doug. It's great to be here.
Now, Janae, you and I have some things in common. I can't walk the balance beam or do a vault, so if you were thinking of that, that's not it. I don't do the gymnast thing and never was good at it. But it's your love to make people laugh and your love of learning. Two of the reasons I got involved in the new sports biz. We're going to talk about your passions during Sports Jam, but explain to us a little bit more about Athletes First Partners and more about your role with the sister company of Athletes First.
Sure, I'd love to. So Athletes First Partners is a sports marketing agency. We're here in New York. We focus on three particular lines of business, sponsorship sales, group marketing rights, representation, otherwise known as name, image, and likeness, and brand and property consulting. We are a part of the Athletes First family. Our elder sister agency is Athletes First, which is the NFL representation agency out of Los Angeles. We launched our business in March of 2018 with our first client, the National Basketball Players Association, and we subsequently added additional clients, including the Retired Players Association, representing both NBA and WNBA players, Fanatics and other blue chip companies in the consulting and sponsorship space. We really built this business on two pillars, which are our key differentiators. So first is the breadth and depth of our experience. We have an incredibly diverse team with experience across a broad spectrum of sponsorship, brand and digital marketing, communications, talent management, and social media. And then the second vertical for us, and one I'm particularly passionate about, is our global reach. So we have the benefit of having really deep international ties, not only internally, with several of us having lived overseas and managed global brands before, but also by working with Dentsu, who is our parent company. They're the advertising agency based out of Japan. So we spend a lot of time really mining the globe, really. So markets like across Asia, Europe, and Latin America. So my role as Chief Growth Officer is I really focus on two things, and a lot of them are reflective of my background. So first is the international space, so building our international strategy. And the second is really looking from a marketing and communications perspective at how we grow Athletes First Partners. We are a little over two years into our business. And one of the things that's most important and that I'm very passionate about is how we grow our brand to support our key business objectives. And those objectives are driving more sponsorship and then also bringing on board new clients, new properties to represent.
Many of your past jobs and this job includes a lot of travel, but because of COVID-19, I'm sure it has disrupted your job completely. How have you been able to manage that?
Yes. So this is actually the first time since, I'm going to say, 2004, where I will, and maybe it's actually a good thing, I will not hit 100,000 miles a year. I typically was on the pace of traveling about 20 to 24 weeks out of every year for many, many years. So I actually am loving the respite. It's different for me. I haven't gotten on an airplane since February. But I manage it kind of the same way everybody else is, through Zoom calls. I'm frankly very happy that we're on an audio call. I've had multiple Zoom calls. I think everybody is getting a little Zoom fatigue. So, but I do think that it's forcing us all to kind of reimagine our business. You know, I spend a lot of time in the international space. I traveled to probably over 35 countries for business. And being in a space now where you're forced to have those conversations in a completely different light is I think it's making me more creative and more focused on what we're trying to do next.
Creating and selling content via online is obviously a challenge, but how have you adjusted as far as what kind of techniques can you maybe share that have worked that some others may benefit from?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, you know, particularly working with athletes, a lot of our focus and my focus kind of early on, even in my previous role with the NBA, a lot of it was the sort of in-person, on-ground contact. So the way that players interact with fans, particularly. What I'm really inspired by is what I see happening kind of across the board. And players are really starting to use, they've always used their platform for brands, for greater good, but they're kind of leaning into it more now. And so some of the things that we've been looking at is really how do we create a virtual world or that virtual connection with our clients and brands.
Janae, during the coronavirus pandemic, the NBA has experimented.
They're calling it the bubble. But think of it as a camp, a basketball camp, with the biggest, fastest, baddest campers in the world. The schedule will be tight, the rules strict, the protocols strictly enforced. Regular coronavirus testing, mask worn when off the court, no exceptions.
So far, the bubble has seemed to work in the NBA. So what are your thoughts on how the league has handled not only the coronavirus pandemic, but the bubble and the resumption of the season?
Yeah, I'm really not at all surprised that it's going well this early on. It's a really impressive operation there. And I think when the whole idea of the bubble started, I was kind of fascinated because just the idea of literally being inside of a bubble for multiple months, I was trying to figure out how that would actually come to life. But having spent a lot of time in the NBA with the operations team there, I figured if it was going to succeed, it was the best chance was with the NBA. And so I think that a lot of this is going to be looked at very closely by other leagues. We're already seeing that happen in terms of how do we enter into this fall. The bubble is really a place where, from a brand perspective and from our perspective, we're looking at, for the first and foremost, the athletes have got to stay healthy. They've got to compete. They've got to do what they need to do to take care of themselves. And so we're looking at opportunities maybe a little further down the road once we see how the bubble plays out.
Janae Elzy is our guest here on Sports Jam, talking to us from New York City. I would imagine that you probably draw a lot more respect from the athletes that you work with, because they know you yourself, a top-notch athlete, a three-time captain at Stanford University, an All-American gymnast, and all this at 5'6", which is rather tall for a gymnast.
Yes, it is. So I grew up, I was always taller. I started gymnastics at the age of 3, and then I started competing at 8 years old. And so by the time I truly got serious about the sport, which sounds a little ridiculous to say considering gymnasts are so young when we start focusing on the sport, but I was about 10 or 11. And so I was always taller than most of my competitors and most of my teammates, but I was always much stronger physically as well. So I actually think it was a benefit because I'm not quite sure that the judges knew what to do with me in terms of when I was out there competing. I made it work to my advantage. So I didn't see it as a difference until, you know, I had teammates and colleagues, you know, pointed out. But I really thought it was an advantage because it was something different. It was something that the judges weren't used to seeing. And then in terms of being able to connect with some of the clients, some of the athletes we work with, I think, yes, an athlete speaks a language that is kind of very unique, and we've all been in the trenches. We've all been through something. It's very much a shared experience. I think the gymnastics experience is unique. All of the experiences are slightly different, but I still, that whole idea of the competitiveness, the discipline, the focus, that's always there. So when I meet another athlete and I'm talking to them, I always get a sense that I kind of understand what they're going through on some level.
You know, Janae, sometimes athletes get a bad rap, and people may be thinking right now, oh, well, Janae was an athlete, that's why she starred at Stanford University. You have a bachelor's degree in economics and a master's degree in organizational behavior. Not only you were an athlete, you were a student athlete who did extremely well with her studies and have proven that through the years as really an expert in the field that you're in right now.
Yeah, so I really was fortunate at the time that I went to Stanford, that I attended Stanford. It was during a time where both the academic and the athletic side were really strong. And so, you know, it was a great experience being an athlete. But one of the things when I was looking at colleges, I was recruited to a couple of different places, UCLA, Oregon State, Stanford. And one of the things I was really looking for was that balance of academics and athletics. And when I got to Stanford, one of the things that I realized very quickly, people were good at a lot of different things. So it wasn't like I came in or anybody came in, any of the athletes came in and had an immediate kind of leg up, or any academic students as well. Everybody was good at something. And so I came in during that time. The other thing that happened was I was there during the early dot-com boom in Silicon Valley. So as far as I knew, everybody could leave. You graduated and it was not a big deal to think, oh, of course, I could write a business plan for a startup and get it funded and get it launched. So we had that kind of entrepreneurial vision, which has really played into most of my career. Most of the jobs that I've had have been very much about building things from the ground up, whether it was literally a startup like Athletes First Partners or Tennis Channel, or building things within an existing division like NBA or an existing company like NBA. So that is very much a product of the environment that I grew up in at Stanford.
Janae Elzy now in a moment on the floor for the Stanford Cardinal, ranked nationally in the top 20 in the all-around 38-52, and there she is stepping on and about to begin as we had a good view of the entire goings-on on the floor of the McHale Center. Janae Elzy, Stanford.
What a difference from her. From Terry Canuck's music.
I like this already.
This is just going to flat get it on. Whip back into a double back. Yes. Oh, yeah. Boy, I like this. Good variety in her tumbling. Good back tumbling, good front tumbling. And obviously, she just moves beautifully. And a back with a pull. Yes. Good stuff, Bill.
High energy, the most physically gifted athlete that Brett Greenwood has ever coached.
One of the guests on Sports Jam many years ago was Gabby Douglas. And of course, the unbelievable Simone Biles has changed the sport dramatically. When I was speaking with Gabby, she talked about how she experienced, you know, racism firsthand. You mentioned a little bit it wasn't always right there. What kind of experiences would you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I think, you know, I grew up very sheltered by my parents. I have two incredible parents who really supported me through my entire career. And in fact, to the point where I think that I don't think they ever missed a gymnastics meet that I competed in the 12 years that I competed competed in gymnastics. And so I experienced racism at a very subversive level. So it wasn't sort of the outright in your face. But there were definitely times where I felt like both my parents grew up in segregated Alabama in the 50s and 60s. And so she was much more keen to understand what was happening and kind of explain it to me. So I knew that there were times, whether it was a questionable judging decision or athletes that kind of left, you know, didn't really make me feel included in the group or inclusive. I could tell what was happening, but my entire focus was just how do I get to be the best gymnast that I can be? So a lot of that was just taking my tunnel vision and moving ahead. I look back at it now, and I look at where we are now in terms of gymnastics, and I see girls like Simone and Gabby. And I'm so grateful that other Black gymnasts and gymnasts of color can have a different experience than I did growing up.
As far as marketing yourself and promoting yourself and brand, what kind of advice do you have for someone like Simone Biles? Because you have all this experience, not only as being a fellow gymnast, but you've had all this. You're a guru now in the, you know, when it comes to the sports and entertainment executive position. What advice do you have for her?
Wow, I don't think I could give Simone Biles any advice at this point. And one of the things that actually, the reason I say that is because what I see in her and what makes her, aside from just her physical abilities are just off the charts, I don't think anyone's seen anything like it ever. What I see, though, in her is that she fully owns herself. And she's fully present and shows up as exactly who she is. And that is not a common trait for a gymnast. You know, gymnasts, I'm going to generalize a little bit here, but you know, for people who start out so young and you're in a sport that is entirely defined by perfection or lack thereof, and that perfection is decided by someone else, you're always living up to someone else's standards. And so there was a documentary recently where Athlete A, where they talked about, I think the line was, as a gymnast, when you ask an athlete to jump, they'll say how high. When you ask a gymnast to jump, they'll just jump because there is no sort of ability or thought about questioning, right? You just do what you're told. And what I love about Simone is she has never done that. She's been unapologetic with who she is. And she has always kind of taken everybody else along because she truly appears to be doing the sport for the love of the sport. And so I think from anybody else, you know, young people, young gymnasts, own fully who you are. And I would err towards that side of being too much like yourself than trying to have someone, trying to fit someone else's mold. So I think she's an amazing role model in that respect.
It's funny that you mentioned that word because I was just going to ask you, do you consider yourself a role model?
Oh, I don't think about it in terms of labels. I do think that one of my passions in life absolutely is mentoring and is working with young people. I've always been inspired by that, whether it's in sports, whether it's as athletes, whether it's as marketers. And I live my life just hoping that I can teach people something. So if that's what they want to call that, if they want to label it something, I'm happy to accept that label. But I for me, it's more about what I truly enjoy doing and what I feel like my purpose is.
I've been checking out El Cerrito High School in California, where you attended. Right now, there's a lot of culture and youth programming going on at the high school. And as we know, during these days right now, diversity is a key issue. Diversity, was it as diverse at El Cerrito when you were there?
Well, El Cerrito, yes. So I was very fortunate to grow up in the Bay Area. And I think one of the things that I thought was that the rest of the world was like that. So it's very, you know, very culturally, ethnically, religiously mixed. And I grew up, I had a lot of friends across the entire stripe. And I really understood that that was kind of the reality. It wasn't perfect. Nothing is perfect. But then I started moving to other places and having other experiences and realized how different it was. So for me, El Cerrito itself was fairly mixed. Now, most of my youth and most of my experience was spent in the gymnastics training facility and in the gymnastics world. And that was very much, I was very much different, stood out. You know, there weren't very many people of color in fact, there weren't really any in the world that I grew up in. I think I saw my first, you know, fellow Black gymnast maybe sometime in high school at the national level. And so I had a very different experience being in gymnastics versus living in a place like the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. Yeah. I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before, no, no.
Yeah. You're listening to Sports Jam, and my guest is Janae Elzy of Athletes First Partners, who was an All-American gymnast at Stanford University and comes from an incredible family. Let's find out some of those stories on this edition of Sports Jam.
Something's got a hold on me here.
Oh, I must be loved.
So strange, everything about me seems to have changed. Step by step, I got a brand new walk. I even sound sweeter when I talk. I said, oh,
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 oh, hey, hey, yeah. Oh, it must be love.
Can you take us back to when you were 9 years old in your first real competition? What did mom or dad say to you afterwards? That were they words of inspiration? You love that word, inspire.
Yes. Well, I actually have. So when I think about the most inspiring story about my parents, it was a little. It was a couple years after that. I was 14 years old, and I was in my first national competition, and I was incredibly nervous. I was 13, and my parents had always said, just go out and do your best, and we're always going to be here for you. So from the time I was 9 all the way through. So the very first national competition I ever was in Richardson, Texas. And I went out. I was incredibly pumped up. My coach had really said, you know, you can do this. This is going to be great. You're on the nationals, in the national spotlight. And of course, I go up on my first event, which was uneven parallel bars, and I bombed. It was a terrible, terrible performance. And from there, I lost my nerve. So the next three events go by. And at the end of the competition, I think I finished somewhere in the dead last category. I think I was probably 97th out of 105 competitors. And I remember they walk you out in reverse order as they're preparing for the award ceremony. And so I'm walking out and everyone's pretty quiet and very politely clapping for the gymnasts as they walk by. And then I hear just this like thunderous roar, like I had just won the Olympics. And it was my parents sitting at the top of the rafters in the gym. And I looked up at them and they could not have been more proud of me. And then I remember the next year, the very next year at the same national competition was where I won my first national. And I had an amazing competition and it was really great. And they go out for the medal ceremony. I'm standing on the podium and that same exact reaction, that same level, they didn't cheer any harder for me when I finished last than when I finished first. And to me, that's what the epitome of being a parent in a sport like gymnastics is about. It doesn't matter how good or how bad or how mediocre you perform. Just know at the end of the day, for me, just to know that my parents were always there and always thought I did an amazing job is what gave me the confidence to go forward.
What a great story of support. You know, I think... And like, there's pressure in all sports, but when I look at gymnastics and I look at figure skating, we're always on edge, even when there's a Simone on the balance beam or there's a great U.S. hope in the Olympics in figure skating. It's so pressurized because it's all about you, and you can be the best, but might not have a great performance, much like you did when you were 13. Mm-hmm. You struggled, but yet you came back. How have you used that? Being able to handle pressure and now your current position, you've used it, I'm sure, throughout your career in business, but how have you used it at Athletes First Partners?
So I think pressure is what you make of it. And, you know, I've spent more time as a gymnast falling down and getting up and figuring out how to come back from a bad performance or how to capitalize on a good performance. So a lot of those life skills I learned very early on, but I still had to think about putting everything in the larger perspective. So at Athletes First Partners, as an example, I try and look at keeping everything in perspective. Everything going on in the world right now, there are so many really, really challenging things. My sister-in-law is an infectious disease doctor down in Atlanta, and they're just worried about how they find more capacity in their hospitals. So for me, you know, figuring out what the next brand partnership and the next client is, yes, there's pressure, but I've always felt that I have to put that in the larger context and, you know, realize I'm not saving lives. I'm doing the best that I can with my own, but it is a different kind of experience when you're, you know, when you truly are, whether it's saving lives or the like.
Can you take us into a conversation that you've had recently with your sister-in-law about the coronavirus pandemic and how you both are handling the situation?
Yeah, so my brother lives down in Atlanta. He and his wife, they have two kids. One of them is 7 months old, and the other one's 7 years old. So as you can imagine, their life is a little bit intense. My brother is an immigration attorney down in Atlanta, so they both have seen kind of different parts of the pandemic and how it's impacted, first of all, you know, communities of color, how it's impacted her as a frontline health worker. And so I always listen to what is going on with them to really understand how the bigger, you know, the bigger issues around this pandemic. And I really can't say much from my end about how stressful or not stressful my job is, because most of our conversations are centered around the family and centered around what they're experiencing. You know, my nephew and my oldest nephew is now in the middle of the debate: do they go back to school or do they stay? So I'm experiencing everything through their eyes, and it gives me a much greater appreciation for just my life. And if the biggest challenge for me right now is, do I stay in the city or do I spend more, you know, spend some time in upstate New York? Because I'm able to do both of those things, then I really can't complain.
I'm sure with the protests that have been going on around the country, especially after the murder of George Floyd, you've had a conversation with your mother, as you mentioned, with her background. Can you tell us what you've talked about with her?
Sure. So just a little background on her. So both my parents grew up in Alabama, as I mentioned. My mother went to George Washington Carver High School in Birmingham, Alabama, in the 50s and 60s. And so this was right in the middle with the dogs and the hoses and Bull Connor. And Dr. King used to come to speak to her school and to the students about this whole idea of this peaceful protest and the nonviolence movement. And so one of the things that we talked about after this happened with George Floyd, and I had so many conversations with colleagues, with other people that I work with in the industry, different boards that I sit on, and all the conversations were around, what can we do to make this better? How do we fix this? And it, for me personally, it was a very intense and very exhausting time, as it was for everyone, as we saw everyone around the world. And I remember I called my mother one day and I said, you know, I don't know how to help. Like, I can't solve systemic racism. And if people are asking me to do that, then, you know, then that's not what I can do. And of course they weren't, but I think a lot of people just needed someone to talk to. And I was one of the Black friends or colleagues that they knew to talk to. And so I was telling her, this has been going on for so long. And so how do you just keep going? And I just feel really tired. And all she said to me was, you know, we were tired too, but we just kept going. And I, in that moment, I just thought, I cannot I can't disengage. I can't be tired. I can't. They had so many more challenges, you know, going from not being able to drink out of water fountains, and just the day she could first drink out of an integrated water fountain was, you know, something to be celebrated. So I'm very inspired by what's happening now, particularly the young people who were her age and that are now really kind of getting out in front of this and getting out in front of the movement. But I always think about both of my parents and how they, what they handed down to this, to my generation, and what my generation can hand down to the next generation. And I just hope that it just gets better and better. That is my hope.
There seems to be mixed reviews from fans and people when it comes to athletes showing their feelings about the country and political views during sporting events. Where do you stand on all of that?
I look at it as I am continually inspired by how athletes are showing up in this world. Whatever they choose to do, the fact that you have athletes that are now saying, I can make a difference, because athletes have always had a unique connection with the fans and the world around them. And it is a time that there was a time that athletes felt like they only had to stay on the court and do what they did, or stay in the gym and do what they did. And you've seen it with the protests. You've seen it now with pandemic response. You saw it a couple of years ago with the Me Too movement. Athletes are really very conscious of the position that they have and the voice and the platform that they have. And I'm really just gratified to see them taking ownership like that. I mean, I look at what's happening now with the Pac-12 and where that's going to go, I have no idea. But the idea that athletes have gotten together and said, you know what, we see some wrongs in this world and we're going to try and make it right, is something that I think whatever side you fall on, I think we all have to be really proud of our athletes for realizing that they actually have a platform and they actually have a voice.
Should they be paid?
Ooh, that's so. I think with the everything that's going on in name, image, and likeness in that space right now, we're watching that very closely because obviously it's very similar to the conversations that were going on in the professional space with the NBPA and why they took their name, image, and likeness rights back. I think there is definitely an argument for it. This argument has been going on since way before I was even a freshman at Stanford. And I think that they have, you know, they have worked, and the universities have absolutely benefited from the athletes that are performing for them. I think what's going to be really telling is how the NIL business is going to develop and what the guidelines are. Because I think it's one thing to say, yes, athletes should get paid. It's another thing to think about all of the potential pieces to that you have to think about. So whether that is recruiting or the guidelines around it, what kind of restrictions are you going to put in place to make sure that the athletes are protected? Because at the end of the day, this is a space that can very easily benefit the athletes, but it's also one that you have to be careful, because what you're talking about, we're dealing with young people who have two day jobs, not even one. They're students and they're athletes. So managing what that looks like and the strains that are going to be placed on those athletes is my biggest concern.
You know, we've talked about some pretty heavy topics during this edition of Sports Jam, and I know you like to have hobbies like dance and yoga, but you love to make people laugh. How do you fit that in, and why is laughter important to Janae?
Well, laughter is really that's what I grew up with. Like, I don't understand. There are a lot of people that have relationships with their families or with their significant others or with other people where there's just very minimal laughter. And I always look at that and I'm like, how does that work? I'm just very curious, because to me, if you don't have laughter, then you know, there's a huge chunk of your life missing. And I actually had a very bizarre fascination with stand-up comedians when I was in high school. In fact, I did my senior year it was called an iSearch paper. It was a research paper where you had to spend an entire year researching what it would be like in a particular field. And I chose stand-up comedy. So I would spend, weekends at the Laugh Factory in San Francisco and interviewing these struggling comedians, because I always thought, like, how does the contrast work? How do you take, and getting on stage and making someone laugh is probably the most vulnerable thing you can ever do. And it was a really interesting, I learned very quickly that I wanted no part of that, because I did not want the pressure of having people to laugh, make people laugh. But if I can do it and there's no pressure, then absolutely. But laughter is just such a critical part of my life.
I could make you laugh in 2 seconds, I guarantee you, because all you'd have to see me do is my attempt of the Iron Cross on the rings, and that would take care of itself.
Yeah, I've seen some people try it. It's not pretty.
It's not pretty at all, Janae. So as we wrap up this edition of Sports Jam, I work for the jazz station WBGO in Newark. Is jazz a part of Janae Elzey's life at all?
Yes. So I would say that actually one of my all-time favorite musicians is Etta James. I love jazz. I wish I knew more about it. I am definitely not a jazz connoisseur, but I can appreciate it. My mother was an incredible pianist. So I grew up with music. I grew up with her singing in the living room as she played the piano. And I was consistently jealous, because I took 1 year of flute, and that was about the extent of my musical pursuits. So I've always grown up around jazz music, and I just love it. When I first moved here, actually, into New York, I spent a lot of time in the exploring different jazz spots around New York. So I spent a lot of time at Jazz Standard, which is one of my favorite places in New York City. Hopefully it opens up again soon. But yes, I love jazz.
What a family you have, by the way. Unbelievable.
And they didn't Elzey. Even pay me for this.
Janae Elzey is the Chief Growth Officer for Athletes First Partners. Once again, she's in charge with developing and implementing growth strategies across international and other non-traditional revenue streams for the agency. It has been a pleasure to have you, Janae, on Sports Jam.
Well, it's been wonderful to be a part of it. So thank you for the invite. I very much appreciate it.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to wbgo.org/sportsjam. Find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts and on iTunes. Special thanks going out to Joe Favorito for hooking us up with Janae Elzey. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.